Thank you. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the July 22nd, 2022 Santa Ana Water Board meeting. We are in person and via Zoom, and this meeting is being webcast and recorded. However, please note that item 12, the tour of OCWD's facility, is in person only and will not be webcast or recorded. For those who are present and want to speak, please fill out a virtual speaker card using the printed QR code or complete a speaker card, both available at the meeting's entrance. If you filled out a virtual speaker card in advance, you will not need to fill out another form. The Water Board can assist you. And for those who have completed a virtual speaker card and are in Zoom meeting, you will be on mute and your camera turned off until it is your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you are done speaking, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting or exit the meeting at that time. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. And as just one other logistic, we have restrooms for those in person just out the door and to your right, or you can ask OCWD staff for directions. At this time, I'd like to ask the board members to please introduce themselves, and I'll start with Director William Rue.
Good morning and welcome to our board meeting. One of the directors. I have been on this board since 2000, and also my other wife, the mayor pro tem for the city of Montclair, just the 57. And welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Rue. Now, Director Gloria Alvarado.
Good morning, everyone. Gloria Alvarado, and it's a pleasure to serve and be here with you live. Thanks.
And Director Scandura.
Yes, good morning. I'm John Scandura. I've been living in Huntington Beach for 29 years, but I was born and raised in the Inland Empire. And I want to thank everybody who's coming here today to be in the meeting, as well as those who are viewing us virtually. And we look forward to your comments and input.
Thank you to my colleagues who are here with us today. Directors Clark and Kerr were not able to join us today, but we wish them both well. My name is Chris Murray. I'm chair of the Water Board and thrilled that we can all be together in person after such a long time working together remotely. I'd also like to just take a moment to wish everyone the very best who are affected by the Hurupa fire, which has broken out today in our region, and we wish the firefighters and everyone who's in the vicinity of that area health and safety and hope for the best that fire is extinguished soon. I know Director Kerr would definitely like me to point that out. There are firefighters are on the front lines this morning. So with that, I'll ask Jane Joy, our executive officer, to please introduce our Water Board staff.
So good morning, Jane Joy, executive officer. For regional board staff, we have Chuck Griffin, who's our environmental coordinator, and Claudia Tenario. She is our regional planning section lead, and Celia Pazos. She works in our stormwater division. We'll be hearing from these folks later. We also have Eric Lindberg. He's our division manager. And our other division manager is Nick Amini. And Ann Sturtevant is my assistant executive officer. And we also have our council, which is Catherine Bramble. She represents us and helps us in a legal aspect. So that's it.
Thank you so much. We'll move on now to item two, our public forum, and we welcome hearing from the public at this meeting. Any person wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker card, and for those items listed on today's agenda, you will make your comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will be limited to 3 minutes. And Jessica, I'll ask, do we have any speaker cards for public forum?
Yes, Madam Chair, we have one speaker. It'll be Sarah Cassette.
Hello, my name is Sarah Passett. I'm a legal intern with the Orange County Coast Keeper, and I'm here to share with you some information about the trash in our waterways. Next slide, please. As a reminder, Orange County Coastkeeper is a nonprofit with the mission of preserving our waterways. Next slide, please. As part of our mission, we host beach cleanups and cleanups of the channels. Next slide, please. This picture shows a common situation where we have natural material that needs to stay on the beach with trash scattered throughout. Next slide, please. And here we see volunteers looking for microplastics along the beach. Next slide, please. The trash here on the left was recovered on April 10th during a cleanup at Bolsa Chica with a total of 56.8 pounds. On the right, we have some of the 182 pounds of trash that was collected on May 20th at Huntington State Beach. Next slide, please. And here are a few of the items that were found on January 14th at the Greenville Banning Channel. Next slide, please. Here we have some of the trash collected at the Santa Ana Deli Channel, including a large tarp. Next slide, please. On February 26th, a total of 900 pounds of trash was collected at the channel. Next slide, please. And on April 28th, 611 pounds of trash was collected at the same channel. Next slide, please. On June 18th, amazing volunteers, including Assembly Member Patron Norris and Senator Min, recovered about 2,500 pounds of trash from the channel. Next slide, please. Here's some of the data from our recent cleanups. There it is. I'd like to highlight the back-to-back dates of July 9th and July 10th, where each day over 100 pounds of trash was recovered. Next slide, please. So far in 2022, 7,762 pounds of trash has been recovered from our waterways. Thank you.
Thank you for that presentation. And I don't know if any of my board members want to speak, but I do want to thank you for the work that you do at Coastkeeper. I joined you on the May cleanup at Huntington Beach, and it was lovely to see how many people come out to volunteer, and I look forward to attending more of those, because the microplastics mixed in with the natural materials on the beach are extensive, and you really had to comb through and pick through to try to get it all. So it really, it's good for everyone to see that in person. I encourage people to join those cleanups. My other colleagues, Director Rue?
Yes, I appreciate what you're doing, keeping this safe for not just the humans, but also for the sea life that is dependent on the ocean. I think it also highlights where we need to make sure that we dispose of everything properly. The trash cans, I was in Huntington Beach for conference just last month, and I noticed there are trash cans everywhere. There's no reason to throw anything into the sand or the ocean. And I think the more we do our share, it's going to help. But thank you for what you're doing.
Director Scandura?
Yes, and also thank you very much for the presentation. I did have a question when I listed the amount of trash that was collected. I noticed there was 2,500 pounds of trash collected on one of the days, and it seemed like an outlier. Is there a reason for that? Microphone.
It's great to see you all in person. I'm Lauren Chase, a staff attorney for Orange County Coastkeeper. That was a big outlier event. We had tons of volunteers. As Sarah mentioned, that event was co-hosted by Assemblymember Claudia Petrie-Norris and Senator Dave Min. So they were able to really rally their constituents to come out. There was also a huge couch that we recovered from the channel on that day. So we weren't able to actually weigh it. That's our best estimate. But that was definitely an outlier event. And we're seeing more and more that the channels are really an impactful source of trash. So it's not just what's on the beach, but what's upstream. And as Sarah mentioned, we had back-to-back cleanups at the same stretch of beach at Huntington State, where on day one, there was over 100 pounds of trash. The very next day, again, over 100 pounds. So source control also very important to responsible waste management. Available for any other questions? Otherwise, I will go sit back down.
Any other questions from my colleagues? Okay, great. Thank you again for all the work that you do. It's so important. With that, we'll move on. Colleagues just want to share, members of the public, we're going to switch items 3 and 4 to accommodate our state liaison, Didi Didamo. She's going to join us remotely. So if everyone will bear with us, we'll move to item 4, which is the regional board meeting minutes of June 3rd, 2022. They're included in our board packet, and I'd like to request, do any of my colleagues have any questions, or do we have a motion to approve?
Madam Chair, I will make a motion for the board meeting minutes of the 3rd of June, 2022.
Thank you, Director Rue. Do I have a second?
Second.
Director Alvarado seconds. And with that, we can call the vote. Jessica.
Board member John Scandora.
Yes.
Board member Gloria Alvarado.
Yes.
Board member William Rue.
Aye.
And Chair Murray.
Aye. Thank you. All right. I hope Dee Dee's available. I don't know who's coordinating with her remotely, but we can move to item 3, which is our State Water Resources Control Board Liaison Report. Jessica, if Dee Dee's available at this time. If she's not, we can move on to the next item and come back to her when she is available. Is that best? Okay. Great. Her reports are very informative, so we will accommodate her schedule and move to item 5, which is consideration of the consent calendar. Item 5 is a consideration of the consent calendar listed as item 6. Is that correct?
Oh, yes.
I'm reading the script here. Okay, at this time, I want to ask if there are any interested parties or a board member request to remove any of the consent items. Any requests? I see none. Jessica, would you please check if there are any speaker cards for item 6?
No, we have no speaker cards for item 6.
Okay. And if no requests or comments, I can request a motion and a second for this item.
Madam Chair, I will make a motion for the consent calendar as presented this morning.
Wonderful. Thank you, Director Rue. Do we have a second?
Second.
Second by Director Alvarado. Jessica, would you please call the vote?
Board member John Scandora.
Yes.
Board member Gloria Alvarado.
Yes.
Board member William Rue.
Aye.
Chair Murray.
Aye. Okay. Any word from our state liaison? Okay. And then this says you, and I'm just going to check with our executive officer. Jane, would you like to move to item 7 at this time?
Yes, we can.
Or item 6, which is our Yorba Linda.
Yeah, item.
This just says skip, so that's why I'm asking.
Yeah, we skip to the next item. So item 7.
Before 6? So we'll do the wastewater surveillance? Yes, okay, I'm sorry. Forgive me, everyone. Okay, item 7, as long as Dee Dee's not available. Okay, item 7 is our wastewater surveillance study and with regard to the COVID-19 pandemic. This is an informational item, and Joshua Steele from the Southern California Coastal Research Project will discuss the state's research activities performed to evaluate if monitoring municipal wastewater for virus associated with the COVID-19 disease could provide valuable information to the state and local health officials of COVID-19 outbreaks. I'd also like to introduce Steve Weisberg. He is the executive director for SCCWRP. He may want to say something as well, and then we can ask Joshua Steele to present the item.
Wonderful. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
So as a tiny bit of background, I think some of you know who SCWRP, Southern California Coastal Water Research Project Authority, is. But for those who don't, what we are is a water quality research consortium. We're a joint powers agency that's formed by 14 water quality management agencies, of which your organization is one. Jane Joy, your director, is one of my bosses, one of my 14 bosses. And we do science not for, we don't do regulation, we don't do policy, but we try and do work that informs policy, is relevant to policy and the regulatory types of decisions that you make. We work on a wide array of things, from microbiology to nutrients to microplastics and debris is the kind of presentation you just heard. And then we also look for opportunities to just help move science along. One of those topics that we've helped move along is how do you, taking the kind of the things that we do in microbiology, we're one of the world's leaders in how you measure microbiology, all the kind of tools that you use on the beach for looking at how much bacteria is there, some of these genetic methods, and then some of the technologies that we use to determine what the sources of those are, whether they came from birds or whether they came from humans or from dogs. Those are all technologies that we've developed. Josh Steele, our speaker, is one of the leaders in the world in doing that. When coronavirus came along, we looked at the opportunity to help move the science of how you measure coronavirus in wastewater. And Josh heads something that the California has a Water Quality Monitoring Council. The Monitoring Council set up a wastewater-based epidemiology committee to help move these kind of things along. Josh is actually the chair of that committee. And Jane thought that you all would be interested in hearing how the wastewater community and the science community has come together to inform how we assess where we're at with respect to COVID prevalence in the population. And so that's a tiny bit of background on SQRP and why I think we're here today. It's, as you said, an informational item, just to kind of where the science is going on that. Any questions about SQRP before I introduce Josh? And
any questions from members of the board?
Okay. So okay, with that, Dr. Josh Steele will get up and talk. Josh is one of the members of our microbiology department. As I said, he chairs the State California Water Quality Monitoring Council's wastewater-based epidemiology committee.
Thank you, Mr. Weisberg, for being here today. And thank you, Mr. Steele, for presenting. And we're honored to have you both with us this morning.
Thank you very much. And thanks for that introduction, Steve. And thanks for the board for inviting us. Next slide, please. So I'm going to talk to you today about the wastewater surveillance that we've done for measuring COVID-19 viruses. And I'm going to just spell out sort of where I'm going here. I'm going to talk to you about why we decided to look in the wastewater for COVID-19 viruses, and then how we sort of developed a monitoring program and went forward, and then where we're going in the future with it. Next slide, please. So I want you to think back to the beginning of the pandemic and remember that we were really in sore need of information about the virus and how it was spreading to make policy decisions. If you all remember, we had the different colors that areas that counties were under, and it could be red, it could be orange, and so forth. And the way we got that information to get those colors were based on the percent of virus in the community. And then we make decisions like, do we need a mask mandate? Can schools open? That type of stuff. The way we got that information, the primary source of that information was from tests that you took when you went to the doctor's office, when you were in the hospital, or if you went to one of the testing centers that was set up. And then, you know, you'd go and you'd get a test, and a few days later, or maybe a week later, we'd get results, and that was how they sort of got this information and make these decisions. But there was a few problems with this data source. Next slide, please. Next slide, please.
One of the things I would note in here is, I think one of the difficulties in measuring this is due to the fact that many people didn't go to testing sites. They simply did the home test kits and never reported. So we don't know that data.
Yes, absolutely. So that, and you anticipated one of the things I was going to say. So thank you. That's awesome. One of the limitations with these clinical tests is currently this data stream is fading. It's, as you pointed out, it's not something, people are getting tested less now that we're in a later phase of the pandemic. People are getting tested, we have the home tests, and so when you measure it, it doesn't get reported. So it's not a data stream that's as consistent. The problem that we had in the beginning of the pandemic too was that there weren't enough tests. And so it was a biased data set. It was only people who had symptoms or were ill could get tested. And so what that was is you were getting the answer of what's the percent of the virus in people who were sick, rather than what we really needed, which was what was the percent of the virus in the whole population. And so these are some of the limitations. In addition to the timing, in the beginning, it took quite a while. We didn't have the home test that you could get 15 minutes later. Next slide, please. So we had a fortunate discovery that if you were sick with COVID-19, you shed that virus in your feces and into the sewer system. And so what we realized was we had another source of data we could tap in order to get this information. And it had a few advantages that had different strengths than the clinical data. There's nothing wrong with the clinical data, but we had another data source here. So it's an unbiased sample. And in this case, what do I mean by that? It's you're getting the broader population. You're getting everybody. Instead of, say, if you were taking a poll for the presidential election, instead of just looking at my great aunt's bridge club and asking them who they wanted for president, which is sort of the analogy for the clinical test, you could pull everybody at once. Everyone groups, it all goes into the sewer system. If we measure it at the source where it comes into the treatment plant, we're getting the entire sewer system's measurement. It's also a data source that won't fade. We're not going to run out of sewage. It's going to keep coming. Usually we have the other problem. We need to figure out what to do with more of it. It also happens to be more cost effective. Instead of testing everyone individually, we're testing one sample at the sewage treatment plant and getting the broad population. And it happens to be faster too. In the beginning, when we were waiting 2 or 3 days for a test, and that was the fastest we could get, when we were testing sewage, we could get the sample in the morning, and by the later in the day, we'd have an answer for how much virus was in that sample. Next slide, please. So hopefully I've convinced you it's a great new data source and that why we should have looked at it, but it took a little bit of doing to get it together. One of the reasons it took a little bit of doing is we hadn't been doing this kind of monitoring wastewater for a while. Probably the last time there was an extensive wastewater monitoring for public health in this way was for polio. So it's been since polio has not really been a big worry that we've had to do this. So first the research scientists had to get their technical house in order. We had to figure out how to go about measuring this. The next impediment was we had to get all the wastewater utilities to say, yep, we're on board. Please come sample our wastewater for this. The health departments had to be convinced to trust and use a new data source. They understood clinical data very well. We had to convince them this data source was also valuable to them. And then finally, we needed a clear and timely mechanism to communicate this data between the agencies and with the public. Next slide, please. Okay, so for the scientists, we had to go back to answer some very basic information. The best ways to get that, to measure that virus, what to sample, should we sample the influence, should we sample solids, how to process them, how often to sample to get the results we needed. And basically what happened, next slide please, was the scientific community came together in a massive effort. Hundreds of labs across the country and the world jumped in on this and started figuring it out right away. And we did studies, we did what scientists do, which is create standard operating procedures, and we all came together and shared this freely to advance the science as quickly as possible. Now, one of the things I wanted to point out is this method comparison studies and how important they can be. Next slide, please. So why do we need to do method comparison studies? Basically because this was such a massive effort, you have people that are experts and people that were just starting out, and everyone was using their own method to try and do this. So what you have here is a method comparison, and you can see in the blue and the green are two of the leading experts in the world at measuring things in sewage or environmental samples, UC Berkeley and SQRP. And you can see how close our data are. They are right on top of each other. We were able to take these same sewage samples and get the same results out of it. We have two other labs that were newer to this. They also were measuring it. And what you can see there, the gray and the sort of orange, when they were able to measure the data, it was fairly close. But you can see that some of the times it drops down to zero. That's not a real zero. That doesn't mean there wasn't any virus there. That means that their method was not as good at detecting it as ours. And so this is the type of thing that we had to figure out, is how to compare methods, how to make sure we were understanding exactly how much virus was there, and then helping these labs that were coming on and doing this for the first time get to where the data matched with the experts who are the leading experts in the world. Next slide, please. Okay, so the next impediment was getting wastewater utilities on board. I'm very happy to say that this was easy. They jumped on in a big way. They stepped up in California, led the way. Over 40 utilities during the first year of the pandemic measured wastewater for this within your area, Orange County Sanitation District. provided samples for us to do method studies. They provided samples for across the country for studies. They provided samples for pilot studies with the CDC. And they're continuing to provide samples for monitoring. They have been a wonderful partner, and it's been very impressive how quickly these utilities recognized the moment and stepped in and jumped in. Next slide, please. Getting health departments on board was our next impediment. They understood that clinical data wasn't perfect, but it was something they knew, and they understood exactly how to use it and what they could do with it. Wastewater, on the other hand, they didn't know as well. They weren't sure what they could do with it and how to use it. So we had to convince them that it was useful and they could use it for making decisions and using it for public health aims. And even worse, they didn't even know who was involved with this. They knew some of the scientists that were, they knew all the scientists that were involved in clinical testing. They maybe had knew some of the scientists in public health areas that they were overlapped with. They didn't really know the wastewater treatment utilities. They didn't really know the scientists that were involved. So we had to make sure they started talking together. Next slide, please. So what did the wastewater surveillance community do? The first thing they did was set up communication lines. And they did this a few different ways. One of them was, as what Steve mentioned, the California Water Quality Monitoring Council created the Wastewater-Based Epidemiology Committee. For those of you that are unfamiliar, the Water Quality Monitoring Council has regulatory agencies and wastewater dischargers and research scientists and public health folks all coming together to talk about shared issues and shared concerns they have. And so this was a natural place for it to occur. And so they set up this committee with, again, everyone involved so we could all talk together and figure out how to get this data source and how to use it. And this built trust. And increased communication, the trust in the data and increased communication among the agencies. Also, the State Water Board and the California Department of Public Health were talking with the CDC, and they agreed to be a pilot program for the National Wastewater Surveillance System. And five California wastewater utilities, four of which are in Southern California, all agreed to be a part of this early study, and they were leading the way in how to do this and how to share this data nationally. And it was a very important part of the process to get that going and get the monitoring up and running to what we have now. And from all of this talking and this communication, what the public health folks told us was, you know, what we really need to see is a graph, a comparison of the COVID viruses you're measuring in wastewater with the incidence rate, with the COVID that we're seeing in the population. Next slide, please. And so we were able to give them that. It took a little bit of time to get enough samples so we could really be sure. Scientists, you know, like to be sure. But what you see here is we have the COVID rate, the average COVID rate on the y-axis on the left here, and the COVID concentration of viruses in the wastewater. And we have really, really good agreement. And once they saw this, along with the data stream and how much information they were getting, it finally convinced them, yep, this is data we can use. This is something we can work with, and really blossomed from there. Next slide, please. Okay, so the last
interesting about the last slide is how close numerically the three agencies are. 94, 94, and 87. Although 87 is a bit of a drop down, it shows this, there's not a wide variance in this. So it shows there must be something That's what I'm looking for. That is very positive about that this is doing it the right way.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, these agencies, I will say that one of the things they have in common is these are large treatment plants with large sewer sheds. And so it's Los Angeles Sanitation on the left, OC Sanitation District in the middle, and City of San Diego on the right. Public utilities. Mm-hmm. And they're big and they're largest plants in each case. So
I'm sorry, I said there's just a 6-point swing between Los Angeles and Orange County and then San Diego. So I'm seeing these numbers are very close.
They are. It was remarkably close. We were very excited about how well we could do with these results. Next slide, please. So the final thing we had to do was figure out a way to communicate the data to across agencies to policymakers to everyone who needed to use this data. You know, scientists like me, we love as much data as you can get. Show us a table with every little number on it. We're happy as can be. That's not always the case. So we had to reach out to data visualization experts and work with folks who understand how to translate this into tools that other people can use. So we worked with public health experts, design experts. Google actually jumped in and helped build dashboards. I'm going to show you an example in the next slide. Next slide, please. So what, like I said, what scientists would love is we just want to see what's on that graph and we want to know exactly what's going on with those numbers. And the public health folks like that too. But they said, yeah, that's great, but that's not enough. We want to know. We want things we can tweak. We want to be able to change the time frame. And so you can see the sliders on the top, the number in weeks, and you know, change the size of the chart so we can zoom in and zoom out. And we want to be able to look at different genes so we can have different measures of the virus and make sure we understand what we're seeing. And maybe can we add variants and can we scale it different ways? And so all of these little tweaks had to be added in so they could really dive into the data in the ways that they found important to make the decisions they needed to make. Next slide, please. So that's sort of the story of how we built the monitoring system and what it is now. And I'm going to go and I'm going to sort of go into where we are and where we're headed next, both with transferring out of the academic research space into the agencies, and then what we can do in the future with this same data source. Next slide, please. So I'm really excited to tell you that California now has a public health wastewater-based epidemiology lab. This, we were so successful at convincing folks of the value of this that the governor basically allocated funds and they set up a new lab just to take in wastewater samples and measure this now and in the future and continue this monitoring program. The research community and all the folks on the wastewater-based epidemiology committee helped transition from the research labs to this lab, doing method comparisons, making sure everything looked the same and that the data was that the historical data still related to the data going forward. So we have this long-term data set that we can draw on. Yes.
And I have a question as it pertains to that. So the new lab, will it be able to provide surveillance for other types of viruses as well? Or is it going to evolve into a broader scope?
I think so, absolutely. I'm gonna talk in a little more detail about that in a minute, but I'll say right now, yes, that's the benefit of this data source is we can use these same techniques and technologies to look beyond, not just at the COVID viruses, but other viruses, other bacteria that we might worry about and anticipate new pandemics. Next slide, please. So I'll just jump to that right now. One of the things that we've realized is not only can we measure just the total number of viruses, but as you saw in the dashboard, we can do different variants. And this has been actually extraordinarily successful. We are able to measure the variants at a very, very sensitive level. And in the case of the Omicron variant back in November and December, we actually detected it in wastewater in California 2 to 3 weeks before they had a clinical sample. So it can also serve as an early warning on some of these emerging threats. Next slide, please. And as you said, this data source contains more than just COVID viruses or variants. We can use it for all sorts of other things. And this is one of the places that the Wastewater-Based Epidemiology Committee and the CDC has started thinking about, and I'm sure other places as well. We can measure other viruses, other bacteria. We can measure respiratory viruses. We found like the flu. We can measure monkeypox. Folks are looking at that right now. We can measure antimicrobial resistance in the population. And that's a worry that is not as immediate as some of these potential pandemics, but certainly a worry that public health agencies have and is important. The other thing that folks have been able to do using slightly different techniques, but the same data source is looking at chemicals. So we can look at not only chemicals that people are dumping down the drain, but pharmaceuticals, drugs, opioids, other things that have broad public health implications into the future. And next slide, please. So back to my roadmap, this is where I covered the why we do this, how we built that, and sort of where we're headed. And I'm happy to answer any questions you all have.
Thank you so much. It's a very thorough presentation and really incredible new emerging technology that will help in so many applications to serve the public. So do my colleagues do we have any questions from the board? Director Rue?
Great presentation. I really enjoy all of the information. I'm looking not at, say, today or tomorrow with our current viruses that are going on in epidemiology, but I'm looking at the potential down the line to start to detect something before it becomes a pandemic, where we can start to use this and say, wait a minute, we're noticing a rise of whatever it is. It's increasing, and maybe the public doesn't yet know, it's not that broad in the public. So I see really great use in future to be even on the preventative side.
Absolutely. I think that is definitely a goal of the scientific community and the public health community to be able to use this that way in the future and detect emerging infectious pathogens. Absolutely.
It's wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions? Director Scandura.
Sure. And again, thank you very much for the great presentation. And just as a little bit of disclosure, so you know where I'm coming from, I did my master's thesis work on viruses in the environment back at the University of North Carolina.
Oh, wonderful.
The professor I worked for had a hand in developing a lot of the methods that are involved in virus detection these days. So I had a few, you know, and I admit a little bit somewhat technical questions. So we go back to slide number 9 and we see, you know, SCWRP and UC Berkeley are data rather closely, but then some wide variation with the private labs. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to verify, did they all come from the same sample source? I mean, almost the same.
Those time? Were split samples. So okay. Sent the same sample split into, you know, mixed together, composited, and then split into smaller aliquots and sent out to every lab. So they all were sampling the exact same thing their own way.
Okay. And then when they actually do sample for these viruses, and do they, is it still using filtration followed by elution and then culturing the viruses?
So everybody did it slightly differently. The way we do it is still using a filtration method followed by extracting the RNA in this case of the viruses. The UC Berkeley used a silica concentration method where they used an even larger volume. So our volume was, you know, between 20 and 50 milliliters. Their volume was about 500 milliliters. And then the other labs were using, and I think why they had that sensitivity problem was a much smaller volume, and they were directly extracting the sewage.
Okay.
So we were concentrating it. That's probably was the main difference and what we recommended they change.
So we see lots of samples of wastewater streams. What about post-wastewater treatment plant? Are we seeing any sampling data on, you know, what's coming out of the wastewater treatment plant?
So there's two ways I can answer that. The first one is in terms of the COVID-19 virus, we early on were concerned. There was a lot of concern that it would be coming out of the effluent stream too, once we realized people were shedding it. But what they found is it's actually, because it's an enveloped virus, it's fairly easy to make it non-infectious, right? You can just regular soap can get it. There's a lot of detergents, a lot of things that go into the sewage stream along with human waste. And so then the treatment process, of course, further disrupts things. And we found everyone that's looked and tried to look really, really hard has not only found that there's no infectious virus coming out of the effluent, but there's not even much ability of the viruses we can measure in the influent to infect anyone. So it's not a health threat to the people doing the sampling. However, we can measure the genes of those viruses coming out.
Yeah.
And so with some of these other targets that maybe are tougher and can make it through, that does become really important.
Oh, okay. And so they think, chlorination that's actually getting the viruses in the treatment plant, or is it something else like UV?
Chlorination does an okay job with some of the viruses. The UV treatment, some of the more advanced treatments, UV or the ozone or, of course, filtration can do an even better job.
Yeah, and that's interesting because, as we all know, not all wastewater treatment plants out there are created equal. You know, some of them, like the one here, has, you know, some of the most advanced methods in the world, but, you know, you have some other areas. So it's probably a good idea to be sampling the post-treatment, the effluent stream.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And then last of all, do they have... so it's great to hear that they've actually set up this wastewater analysis lab. with CDPH, right?
It is, okay. CDPH.
Mm-hmm. CDPH. And have they actually established which viruses they're going to be looking for? Because certainly we're going to be looking for the coronavirus variants, but also hepatitis, influenza, of course, monkeypox.
They have not made those decisions yet. What we've discussed is certainly monkeypox, and some of the research labs are looking at and figuring out exactly how they want to measure that. But also influenza virus, because the clinical surveillance of that, it's again not a terribly reliable data source. This would be a better one, and they can measure influenza. Hepatitis they would certainly be able to measure. Respiratory syncytial virus is also another one that they've been looking at, and then the enteric viruses, of course, as well, like norovirus, things like that.
Okay, good. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. I've just been alerted by Jane that Dee Dee is on the line with us now. I want to thank you very much for such a thorough report and all the work that you're doing. It's incredible and really setting a new standard for measuring in viruses of all types, but certainly the COVID pandemic. So thank you. With that, I'll turn it over to Jane and or Jessica to help facilitate Dee Dee's presentation.
Can we bring Dee Dee on through the as a participant panelist?
Hello?
There she is.
Well, you can hear me, but oh, there we go. I'm looking for a way to turn the video on. Good morning. Well, good to see you all. Sorry, I was a little bit late. I'm at a conference and was speaking at their breakfast. So I will start off with urban conservation and provide you with some information about the latest numbers that we're seeing. Statewide urban water use in May was, I think the last time I reported, we actually were seeing an increase in use from the April 2020 numbers. And in May, we finally are seeing that the trend is starting to shift here a bit. In May, we saw use reduced 3.1% in May of this year compared to May of 2020. And we adopted in May, we also adopted a regulation requiring urban water, the larger urban water suppliers, to activate what's called level 2 of their water shortage contingency plans that implement conservation actions that are identified to get them to up to 20% of conservation. And so when we adopted that regulation, we also have a prohibition of irrigation of non-functional turf in the commercial, industrial, and institutional sector. And so we're really hoping that with the adoption of that, things are going to start to turn around. And I think I've mentioned this before, that we have a little bit of a lag in reporting because by the time the water suppliers get us the information and we tabulate it, we're always about a month and a half, 2 months behind. But what the governor has had some opportunity because of his interest here to directly dialogue with some of the urban water suppliers and requested them to provide for, you know, early reporting. And so they've done that. And the preliminary data that we have for June that represents about 40% of the state's population shows a water savings of 8%. For June of this year compared to June of 2020. So it's definitely, you know, showing that the trend is starting to change, but we're tracking this very closely and, you know, there always is a possibility for us to take further action. And as we do that though, we are moving forward, of course, on the long-term efficiency standards. And I've talked to you about this before, the water loss performance standards. We expect that we'll be adopting those in by mid-October, having a workshop August 17th on water loss performance standards. And this is the issue of standards that are community specific as to fixing leaky pipes, taking actions that are cost effective. We don't expect all leaks to be addressed, but those that are cost effective for the communities, we're expecting that that occur. And then switching gears here over to a couple of updates on stormwater. We adopted earlier this year the Caltrans permit, and now moving forward on the construction general permit, we expect that we'll be adopting that in September. And then as soon as that is wrapped up, we'll be moving forward, staff will be moving forward on an update for the industrial general permit. And then also our staff has been working very closely with regional boards on the update of language for the MS4 program. And also as part of these activities, we have this program that's been underway for a while. It's called the STORMS program. And this is the strategy to optimize resource management of stormwater. And there are a number of different pilot programs that are involved in that. But one in particular that I'd like to call to your attention, and that has to do with cost reporting by the regulated community in an effort to better develop an economic analysis template. This is something that I've been interested in since coming to the board, and that is, you know, trying to do a better job assessing the economic impact of our regulations, whether it's a general order or the actions that you all take at the regional board, and trying to have, you know, more standardized a way of collecting economic impact information, and then hopefully if we have a template that can be utilized also by the regulatory community, it'll put us in a better position to be able to compare apples to apples when those that are impacted or the NGO community comes in to say, you know, it's really not that much, it's actually quite a bit less. And as this project has been underway, because, you know, this could be helpful in a number of different areas, but the focus that our staff has had is to start off with stormwater so that we could have more of a targeted focus in the beginning. And there was a workshop that was held in April, and the feedback that our staff got was that the regulated community was quite concerned because of viewing this actually as a requirement, an additional requirement on reporting of cost. And so we're trying to work through that information. And I just call this out because the conference that I am at, it's with the California Council on Environmental and Economic Balance. I just requested that they, and as I talk with, you know, others in the regulated community, you know, encouraging them to help us along with this so that we don't end up with this being viewed as just another layered regulatory requirement, but really, you know, the intentions are good. We're trying to collect this information in order to do a better job to determine the economic impacts. So anything you all can do to, you know, help message on that would be greatly appreciated. And then shifting gears over to racial equity. I know this is something that all the regional boards are interested in as they embark development of their own racial equity initiative or resolution modeled after what we did at the state board. We're currently hosting a series of workshops where participants will be able to learn about our ongoing racial equity efforts and actively join in developing the draft racial equity action plan. And so we have four workshops that are underway. One took place 2 days ago. There's going to be two next week. And so we're really excited about the level of interest that we've received in this. And then we expect that the action plan will be presented to our board later this year. And then turning over to budget, the governor did sign the budget bill on June 30th, and the bill did include a number of specific funding for water board items such as emergency drinking water, drought response, SRF, et cetera. But I think what I'd rather do is just report on this the next time I see you, because there will be final budget negotiations, but instead provide you with more detailed information about expenditure of funds over the last year. So in the in this last year, we the water boards collectively allocated $3.3 billion, which is double the amount that we did allocate the year before and four times the amount that we allocated 2 years ago. And so, you know, we're really seeing this generational opportunity because of the infusion of federal dollars and also state dollars and also some of the bonds that had been adopted in years past, Prop 1 and Prop 68. And so this is really going to make a difference in the lives of Californians. And so specifically, almost $1 billion for safer drinking water, $1.1 billion for wastewater and stormwater, $26 million for drought, and then $1.2 billion for recycled water. And I know that's something that you all are very much interested in. And it's a handful of programs in particular on recycled water that are going to result in about 75,000 acre feet of additional water supply projected by the year 2030. So it's just really exciting, despite, you know, some of the sobering times that we're in, to be able to have this generational opportunity. And then the last thing I wanted to update you on is the on-site wastewater treatment systems policy, also referred to as the OTS policy and the conditional waiver. Our board adopted this policy in 2012. Reissued in 2018, and then it needs to be renewed every 5 years. And our staff has been working with the regional boards on that. We don't expect that there will be significant revisions, but there's some key areas that need to be focused on. I know of the interest in particular, Member Rue, in, you know, housing, in the housing issue and addressing the development of additional ADUs as part of that policy, and then also including newly listed impaired bodies of water and including a new mapping tool. In September, there'll be a 45-day public comment period that'll start September 16th, and then we'll have a staff workshop on the 4th of October, and consideration of adoption is expected for next year in April. And that's all I have for you. Look forward to any questions.
Thank you. Director Rue?
Yes, thank you, Dee Dee, for the very thorough report. I appreciate it, especially the issues on racial equity and the information you bring up about wastewater treatment. One of the questions, and it may not relate directly to what we do, that affects all of California, in the state budget, is there any money to do something up in the Bay Delta? We know that that is a very fragile environment up there, and for many years we've needed to improve the infrastructure. Will there be any money in the budget for that?
A significant amount, yes. Thank you for the question. So as we embark on updating the Bay Delta plan, there's been tremendous interest in voluntary agreements. You know, where the governor directly has asked his two secretaries and his cabinet secretary to work with a lot of the entities that would be subject to the new standards. And there's a framework document that they have that they announced. It's probably been about 2.5 months. And I don't recall the specific amount, but in the governor's May revise, there was a significant amount of funding set aside for restoration. And as I understand it, the language that's included in the budget is broad enough to be able to be utilized for these voluntary agreements, should they come to fruition. So right now, I think we just have a framework and we're looking for more details. I'll make sure I include that when I report back on the final budget numbers next time I see you.
Thank you so much. And thank you for your efforts as well, Dee Dee.
Thank you. Director Alvarado?
Just echoing the gratitude for a great report and looking forward to not only seeing the completed budget, but also hopefully the action plan for the racial equity. Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you, Dini, for your time, especially since you're at a conference. We always appreciate how thorough your reports are and look forward to the follow-up at our next meeting, particularly as it pertains to funding for some of our more critical stormwater and other programs. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I'll just say, Chair, I really want to thank you for the discussion that we had and just sharing this with the rest of your board about communications and trying to be better coordinated with our communications shop on getting this information out. And so the press release that that just came out day before yesterday on funding is something that I think you all will find very helpful. It's got a lot of really good links on the specific programs, and we're going to try to do a better job coordinating. There's a lot of moving parts, especially with funding. It's easy to get lost, because there's just so much that's out there.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to partnering with you on that so that we can get all that information down to the grassroots level for all the communities we serve. So thank you again.
Thank you. Good to see you all.
Good to see you. Okay, thank you. With that, we'll move on to item 8, which is also an informational item. And Celia Pazos and Jane Joy will provide an update on the region's Human Right to Water Work Plan. I'll invite Celia to come forward to present the item.
Oh, hello. Good morning. Sorry, let me adjust this really quick. A little awkward to see you all in person, but I'm happy to be here and meet you all. So welcome, everyone. Welcome, board members. My name is Celia Pazos. I'm going to be giving an overview presentation today on the Santa Ana Water Board's Human Right to Water Resolution and the work plan. I'm going to be presenting along with our Executive Officer, Jane Joy. A lot of the projects that we're going to talk about today are the result of like hard work and collaboration of various staff. So like we're giving the overview presentation, but it is lots of other folks involved, and a few of them are here to answer specific questions if you have them. So I just wanted to throw that in at the beginning to let you know. So the intro slide, just wanted to point out that we have a couple of images from around the region. It's Huntington Beach, some recreation in the Santa Ana River, Prado. Just wanted to point that out and show you. Next slide, please. So the human right to water, what is the human right to water? It was codified in California with Water Code Section 106.3, and it established every human being has the right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes, like it says on the slide there. Section 106.3 also directed all relevant state agencies to consider this policy when establishing or adopting policies, regulations, or grant criteria. In 2016, the State Water Board adopted a resolution establishing the human right to water as their core value. And the principles of the human right to water come down to four factors. So it's that water is safe, clean, affordable, and accessible. Next slide, please. So in 2019, the Santa Ana Water Board, this board, passed their own human right to water resolution. So this board established the human right to water as a core value in the region and committed to advancing human right to water in all of our programs. This resolution included a work plan, and there are various tasks on the work plan across all of our programs, and we've been working on them since then. And so that's what we're going to be talking with you, talking about with you today. Next slide, please. So a little bit about the Water Board's role in the human right to water. We just followed State Board liaison Beatty Diadamo. She talked a lot about State Board divisions. And so this slide is here to kind of explain the State Water Board's role and the Regional Board's role in the human right to water. So what we've seen is that achieving the human right to water is really a collaborative effort. And one of the main partners we collaborate with is the State Water Board, and their divisions that we collaborate with are listed there, the Division of Water Rights, Financial Assistance, and the Division of Drinking Water. And the State Water Board establishes policies, regulations, and grant criteria for funding. And that's their role. The Regional Board supports the human right to water with their authority to ensure that our programs are fair, equitable, and ascertain that all four factors are considered in our programs. And so again, the factors are safe, clean, affordable, and accessible. Next slide, please. And so that's what we've been doing. We've been considering this human right to water and implementing it in our programs. So I'm going to overview a few of the completed tasks that we've been working on since then. So like I mentioned, the Santa Ana Water Board Human Right to Water Resolution included a work plan, and regional board staff have been working on those tasks since the resolution was adopted. We started with a program assessment that was back in 2020. Santa Ana Water Board staff from all of our programs completed an internal assessment with a human right to water lens. Staff reviewed program goals, objectives, and activities, and then considered possible correlations to the human right to water. And that assessment's ongoing. We talk about it and meet periodically and adjust as necessary. I'm a little nervous to be here in person, so forgive me. Thank you. So we've also drafted regional maps that depict areas of groundwater contamination, and we've compared those with other overlays that we have, other data sets that we have, such as disadvantaged communities in Region 8. So we've created a bunch of maps with our program data, and we use that as part of the assessment. It's kind of just a big ongoing conversation about how this human right to water interrelates to all of our work. We've also coordinated with Chino Basin Water Master and other stakeholders to obtain regional water quality data, including PFAS data. And we issued this community fact sheet in the last summer of 2020. And we distributed this fact sheet to well owners, private well owners that may have impacted water supply wells, including PFAS. And so that was one of our outcomes. Next slide, please. We've also updated regional maps showing state small water systems using the State Water Board's data. And then we drafted Cal and BioScreen maps for our region. And in a nutshell, Cal and BioScreen is a data tool that was developed by OEHA. And it gives each community in California a score. And that score considers various factors, including socioeconomic factors and also like water quality and pollution data. So we created regional maps using this data. And we can use this data in a variety of ways, including like prioritization of enforcement or inspections. And Jane will touch on that a little bit in the later portion of our presentation. And then we also drafted regional maps using SAFER data. So again, Dee Dee talked about it a little bit in the liaison report, but we have used the State Water Board SAFER data to draft our regional maps. Next slide, please. This should be a blown up version. Yeah. So this is a map of our region showing SAFER data. And SAFER aquifer risk map shows the relative risk of groundwater in an area that may not meet primary drinking water standards. So they take a whole bunch of water quality data, and I think it's from DWR and various entities, and they combine all that data and give each community a score, a risk score. So the cooler colors or the blue colors show a lower risk score, and the hotter colors or the red colors show a higher risk score. So again, this is our region showing all of the shading. The red zones show the highest risk of impacted water quality, and the blue zones show a lower or no risk of impacted water quality. And then, like I said, we have other types of data, including disadvantaged community data. So we overlaid the disadvantaged communities on this map. They're the ones that are highlighted there. And I just wanted to point out that the water quality risk ranking is not intended to depict actual groundwater quality concentrations at a particular location. It's meant more to, the purpose of this analysis is more to give, to prioritize areas that may not be meeting water quality standards and, you know, potentially additional sampling or investigation efforts. So it's not intended to depict water quality at that point. So I just wanted to point that out. Next slide, please. So other ongoing activities, like I've mentioned, we've do a lot of collaboration with the State Water Board's Division of Drinking Water. We've identified locations of impaired drinking water systems in disadvantaged communities and environmental justice communities within our region. We've also collaborated with them to identify impaired water systems for the Supplemental Environmental Projects list. We added 3 sites to that list in 2020, if you all remember. And that list is ongoing. We can add sites to that list at any time, so we continue that conversation as well. And then we're also collaborating with the W2ID projects that may be eligible for state funds through Proposition 1 or SAFER. And Jane's actually going to talk about a few of those projects in just a minute. Next slide, please. Other ongoing activities. This is in collaboration with DDW and Division of Financial Assistance. We're working with them to ID state small water systems and DACs and continuing the conversation about availability of funds. including funds to support emergency response for repair of water systems after natural disasters. And like I mentioned, those meetings and that those conversations are ongoing with regional board staff. We're going to be going into some of the projects that support the human right to water in our region in some more detail. This is just a little bit of the background section, so I'm going to pass it over to Jane, who's going to give some more specifics on the human right to water.
Thanks, Celia. Appreciate it. So, Chair Murray and board members, I really appreciate the opportunity to bring this information item to you. It's one of the areas that I think our region excels, and I'm really proud of the work that we do. You can go to the next slide, please. So the first project I'm going to talk about, I think a slide got moved. So one of the areas where we see a huge benefit for putting in, say, an inland desalter is the use of Prop 1 funds. These funds come to us, they're lowest interest rate, or they're grant funds that come to these agencies to build these facilities that are very expensive. And so one of the messages I want to make sure that you all have is that when these funds support us, it creates a more affordable practice for the local agencies. So, and these come from the state board, and the state board manages these. So state board and us, we're regulators, we're looking at water quality, but the state board is also a huge funding source, as Dee Dee said, and she'll talk about it at next week, but it's significant. And right now we're in a really good place, but it has a really a significant aspect on making water affordable for all, which includes the disadvantaged communities. Next slide. And all these projects I'm going to talk about have benefited from the Proposition 1 and additional funding sources. Quail Valley is something that we have been talking about for years. And I know board member Rue knows this one very well. And it is basically, this is truly a disadvantaged community. Quail Valley is located northeast of Canyon Lake. And it's actually been incorporated into the city of Menifee. And early on in 2006, there was a full prohibition of new septic systems within the area because of the public health issues of surfacing septage, as well as high bacteria in Canyon Lake. So there was a real serious source there, which there we're still actually dealing with, to be very honest. But it was a kind of a prohibition of all those areas. You can see on the map, there's sub areas 1 through 9. And as we looked at it, the solution is to provide sewers to the area. This is not an easy area to sewer. The topography is very, very much changing. There are huge boulders throughout the area. It's very difficult to just even trench a small sewer line. So the gravity solution, which you normally have in our facilities, is not going to be a solution for Quail Valley. And so after learning all that and looking more at detail of where the actual failed systems are, in 2020, the prohibition was reduced to areas 4 and 9. And 4 and 9 is where there's over 100-150 failed septic systems. I've been out there and have seen the septage on the surface. It's a very significant problem area. So we did make that reduction in the prohibition. And so Eastern has been working diligently to provide sewer to this area. As of today, phase one, which provided sewer to sub area 9, it's sewered 150 homes, 70 vacant lots. It also provided the main gravity-fed sewer line to the facility that would take it back to the treatment plant. So you had to do the main stem. One of the things I wanted to say before I talked about the phases is the phases of the project are based on how much money has been collected for that site. It's not based on logic, like technical areas. It's all based on funding, because the funding to sewer this area is on the order of just these two areas, $30+ million. It's a significant source. These are disadvantaged communities. There's no funding within the community to provide much support.
So phase one was funded using our supplemental environmental project funds, which was about 200,000. There was some grant funding of about 500,000 for planning. 2 million came from the Prop 1, and then federal state revolving principal forgiveness program was 12.2 million, and that's just phase one. So as Eastern has been and working with the other stakeholders have been collecting these funds, again, okay, we got $12 million, what can we do with it? Okay, we can sewer sub-area 9. The next phase they're looking at sewering is sub-area 4. This is called the grid area. There's about 540 homes in that area. Again, it's very rocky, it's very tight. The roads between the lots, I think it's a one-way road. There's a lot of complications in sewering the area, but they are moving forward. They have on the order of potentially the money's not completely approved yet, but about 200,000 to do some of the geotechnical studies. And this is from the Disadvantaged Community Involvement Technical Assistance Program. They've also looking at the Clean Water Small Community Planning Loan, which Celia had mentioned, about 500,000 there. And they also have earmarked with support from Representative Calvert for $2.5 million for construction. Those aren't approved yet, but they're coming into play. So next slide. So all this to say is that it's an expensive project, an expensive endeavor. The end result's gonna be helping to clean up Canyon Lake and making that community safe. So it's a viable project. Septic to sewer projects are very important, and they're very important in our region. But at the January 2020 meeting, Chair Murray said, let's get together, let's figure out what we can do to push this forward further. So there is a Quail Valley Septic to Sewer Task Force, and we're working side by side with Eastern and all of the other stakeholders such as Menifee, Riverside County, Canyon Lake. There's a resident coalition called the Quail Valley Environmental Coalition. It's the residents, local residents. And we also have Elsinore Valley, a municipal water district there, because their district butts up against Quail Valley and may actually receive some of that sewer into their system. And so it's been effective. One of the areas that we've been trying to, the goal is to strategize, how can we get funding? How can we provide support? And just in April, Eastern came and requested us to provide a letter of support for the USEPA state and tribal assistant grant funding. And it looks like that will produce about $2 million. Again, this is all still in the application and not stamped approval yet, but they received 13 support letters from this task force. So I do think it's effective. I do think that we are putting our minds together to come up with some good solutions. And hopefully we can see this community restored to a healthy, safe condition. So that's Quail Valley. Next slide. The other projects, now these projects aren't necessarily earmarked as disadvantaged community projects. And I kind of labored over, well, do we talk about it here or not? But I do want to convey how we're working with some of these water resource, recycled water, desal facilities, water quality management for salt and nutrients, and how they all come together to produce a safe, clean, affordable, accessible water supply for everybody. And it includes the disadvantaged communities. And a lot of these are taking place, most of the ones I'm going to talk about are Inland Empire, but it's also occurring in Orange County as well. But the Paris II desalter, so just as an example of what I'm trying to convey is that this is a desal facility that produces 5.4 million gallons per day, supports about 15,000 homes within Eastern Municipal Water District's watershed. It's an add-on to some of their already desal operations. And so their total desal
is 14 million gallons per day. And what they're desalting are groundwater basins that have been impaired by past practices of mainly agricultural and dairy type of processes. So the salt in the groundwater is very high. The nitrates in the water is very high. There's actually perchlorate as well that in this particular project that's part of fertilizer and some of these other things that come out from an agricultural use. So if there was no desal, the water is unusable. It's not drinkable. It's not usable for agricultural purposes. It's basically a sunk basin. So what we've done is, and what they're doing is they're actually taking that water, treating it to drinking water quality, and using it directly into their potable water system. And then the brine or the waste side of this stream goes into our Inland Empire brine line. Was my opinion, genius, putting that line in, because one of the most expensive aspects of a desal facility is brine disposal, especially inland. You can't just put it everywhere. It's really pretty pretty toxic stuff, and we don't want it to re-enter into the groundwater basins. So that brine line serves the purpose of putting that brine into the ocean, and the brine is nowhere near the saltiness of the ocean, so you're not going to have an impact down there. It's just a very good solution for us, and I think it's created some wonderful opportunities.
And Ms. Joy, for those who are perhaps visiting us virtually, this type of desalination is quite a bit different than what we have been dealing with for the last 20 years on the coast. It's a different type of desalination.
Yes. Yeah, it's treating a whole different quality of water. So if I can put it in terms of concentrations, if that helps, some of these brackish groundwater basins that are being treated by like the Paris Desalter, the salinity is like 8 to 10,000. So it's not drinkable. It's not good for plants. But if you go to the ocean, it's 35,000. So it's like it's not as salty as ocean. So the treatment is not as expensive to do these, to fix these inland basins as it would be to do ocean desal.
You don't have the as much of an issue with marine life.
Right, right. These are all, so the way you feed an inland desal facility is through just a regular designed for like a municipal potable well, drinking water well. So just an extraction well. Yes, thank you. That was very, very helpful. So again, you can walk away with anything, is that this facility is multi-beneficial. So what we've done, what we do is we're working with the agencies. So when they're gonna do a desal to clean up one of these groundwater basins, these agencies are also producing a recycled water through their wastewater treatment plants. The recycled water that's produced is of a good quality that can be used for irrigation and can be used for non-potable purposes. It's good quality. However, it may have slightly excessive salts and nutrients. The nutrients are used by the plants. The salts get applied at probably a greater level that if we were just looking at that discharge, we probably wouldn't allow it. So what we do is we say, okay, we can see the multi-benefits of this. So if you apply this recycled water at this salt quality, we're going to require you to take that much salt out using your desal. And there's a whole, it's a spreadsheet. How much did we put in over what a limit would be? And how much are we taking out? And we require them to take out as much or more, and it's usually more. And so it creates this really great cycle where we can increase the use of recycled water because it has value. It is not drought resistant. It is there every day and produced every day. And it can become a piece of that water portfolio pie that just manages a lot of these demands, and it also reduces that demand on imported water. Every agency within Southern California is relying on the Delta and on the Colorado River water supply, and part of the focus is to make sure that that piece of pie is as small as it can be, if not eliminated. So these kind of projects produce that. And it's kind of a win-win for all. We're protecting the water quality. We're producing a water resource that's affordable, accessible, clean, and safe. I'm really proud of how these things are coming together. And we're doing it in multiple areas. So, and it's being proposed to happen again and again. So we're seeing these small desal plants coming into play, and we're going to see more of them. And it's really, we have wonderful wastewater and water agencies. They're willing to sit down with us. We can sit at the table and be a part of the solution. And I feel like my job is to protect that and make sure that that stays viable. So that's what I'm trying to do. I'll go more quickly. Next slide. There was a ceremony. Chair Escobal was present at the ceremony to open the Paris 2 desalter. And his quote is, "This facility and other projects funded by Proposition 1, together with Governor Newsom's historic three-year $5.2 billion investment in California water systems enacted last year, and the billions in funding coming from the federal bipartisan infrastructure law provide us with a generational opportunity to transform our state's water system to meet 21st century challenges of a changing climate." A lot in that statement, but it just shows you that we're all on the same page. State board supporting these types of projects, we think they're viable, and it was good to have him there to see that facility. It's a very beautiful facility. Next slide. I'll go to the next slide. That's the desalter in the bottom. It just looks like a regular warehouse. Next slide. So another project, very similar, is in Inland Empire, and this project is got a little bit more of a focus on an actual cleanup site in a plume that's located within the Chino Basin, and they partnered with Inland Empire Utility Agency. We call them IUA for short, but it's very similar. So in order to help to control this plume to a greater degree, they're gonna actually put in an extraction well to remove trichloroethylene, nitrate, and TDS. These compounds are readily treatable to drinking water standards. That extraction well will be put into the plume. It will then be pumped to three air strippers and the Chino 2 desalter facility, which is very similar to what's the desalter facility I just described. And you can see all of the cities here that are involved in that process. The next slide. And, you know, this has very similar benefits from the salt and nutrient management point, from controlling a impaired groundwater body that was no longer viable. But one added benefit in this one is that when you do put in an extraction well, it can also begin to control the movement of that plume underground. You know, groundwater has this natural way of moving, and this extraction well will actually put some controls on how far that will go. And it's been predicted to protect several of the private wells. So, and one of the things that IUA did do is they looked at the residents that are actually considered disadvantaged communities located within their area associated with this project, and it's 275,000 people. So again, these things are funded with Prop 1 funds, low interest rates, grant funding, and so the agencies do what they can to make this an affordable supply and also make sure it meets all the drinking water standards. Next slide. You did hear in March about the Anaheim trading credit program. And I just wanted to highlight it is that this is a regional stormwater program which develops credits to help agencies to come into compliance with the MS4 permit. It's a regional solution. It collects the first flush of an area, protects the area from that first flush, which is typically the most contaminated source of water. And it also takes that water and puts it in the ground. And so we have more supply. Again, it's multi-beneficial, but it does this also, these type, I just want to give them examples. These are the types of projects that that serve the community. They provide, more drinking water. These are cost-effective solutions. It's more effective in this scenario to do a regional solution. Plus, it also creates a really nice park. A lot of the disadvantaged communities rely on the free facilities for their recreation and enjoyment. Next slide. All this to say, and we have a couple slides here, but I won't take the time to go to each one, but I just want to leave you with is that, you know, when we started really looking at the human right to water and the adventure, what does it mean? We developed these wonderful maps, and Celia has been so I just want to, highlight what she's done. She came up and spoke, but she's done a lot behind the scenes. She's a very creative and diligent to get us this mapping together and to help us understand how to look at human right to water. But I just want to say that we're taking this knowledge and this mapping system and applying it to all our programs. How do they apply? Are we doing the right thing? Are we being fair and equitable? And I wanted to raise these projects because I think we are doing it, maybe not when these were originally developed with the intention to protect disadvantaged communities, but we are doing some of it. Can we do more? Yes, of course we can. And so now that we're looking through this lens of human right to water within each one of our programs, whether it's stormwater or cleanup or identification of our planning of protecting or cleaning up impaired waters, we're throwing this lens of how are we impacting the disadvantaged communities and what can we do to make sure that we're being fair and reasonable. And in some cases, maybe even promoting it if we're seeing that that they've been dealing with pollution much at a much greater degree than maybe some other areas. So I just want to leave you with that, is that we have work to do. We really have quite a bit of work to do, but we are looking at our programs with that perspective. And I'm really proud of how staff has taken on the initiative. You know, we ask them the question, they're like, oh, okay, let's look at it. Let's look at it in that way. So I think that's all I wanted to say. Did I get it? Yeah, anything you want to add? Okay. Okay. All right, next slide. I think we're done. But if there's any questions, we're here to ask, okay. So there is, Celia talked about the safer data, and I'll just read what this new data set will do. And this is going to help us to make some of our decision is the groundwater quality risk maps that are coming out of SAFER. They're summarized in a census block group. And this allows us to look at water quality risk combined with the census information, such as the disadvantaged community and demographic information. And so we're kind of combining these water resource drought, water shortages, and some of these other things that are happening, looking at the whole picture rather than just the sum. So, you know, technology is such that we're really able to gather and look at a lot of information in layers, and we're doing that. And so that's what's coming. And again, I already mentioned septic to sewer. We have identified a couple areas that we're pursuing within our region to see if we can't get them some of these abundance of funds to make some changes on how they manage their waste. So I think I'm done. Any questions?
Thank you, members of the board. Director Rowe.
I appreciate the efforts on the human right to water, especially among economically disadvantaged communities. These are the communities that are quite often the most vulnerable and where the resources aren't there. So that effort is really well done. In regard to Quail Valley, in looking at some of the funding sources, I think it's really important that the water agencies, the sewering agencies, municipal governments, the county really step up. This is a truly disadvantaged community, and the bulk of this can't fall on this agency, the state of California. It needs to be on the people who are there. This didn't happen overnight. this has been going on, and there have been warning signs out there. And what I find interesting is many of the agencies that will say they can't afford this will find money for other things. So I'm glad we're continuing to put the pressure on them. I've been dealing with this issue for a long, long time on this board, and we've had meetings down there, and the residents are frustrated. And again, if you're an agency down there and you can afford money, you know, to do something else, you need to start budgeting for Quail Valley. It's just the way it has to be. And it's not right that other entities are picking up the cost when it's truly an issue for those families and those residents, and it shouldn't fall on the residents of Quail Valley. They're already disadvantaged as it is. So I'm glad we're putting pressure on them. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Any other directors who'd like to speak at this time? Director Alvarado?
Thank you. I just wanted to say how wonderful it is to see how things are moving forward. Affordability of water has been an issue in the last, well, we talked about 20 years, but in the last couple of years, that has been the conversation, right? And I think this is why it's so important that we're looking at every single avenue to bring not only funding, but to actually include the perspective of the community. So I want to thank you for that effort and for all the work that has been done. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Scandura?
Sure. I have just a couple questions on the technical presentation. I think going back to slide 5, it was mentioned that we're working with Chino Basin Water Master. Are we also working with any of the other water masters in the region, like Orange County or out in the San Bernardino Riverside area?
I think I might have
an IEUA. Hi, yeah, exactly. So we do partner with multiple agencies to obtain data, and we've gotten it from various sources. So either that it has been shared with the regional board or staff has asked for it. And like I mentioned that we meet periodically and talk about the human right to water and its applicability. So sometimes out of those conversations, someone will say, hey, do we have this data or do we know who may have it? So staff are very proactive and successful at coordinating and obtaining data. So I don't have specifics, but I probably, and we can look into the definitive answer for you on that. But we do work with various agencies, even like Riverside County Flood Control for homeless encampment data, like all kinds of data. So probably is the short of it. Yes, Janel.
Yeah.
Well, haven't we been working with like Western Municipal, Eastern Municipal, IEUA, Chino Basin Water Master? I'm going to leave a whole bunch of them out here. So that's good to know we're doing that and continuing.
Yeah, so there's a group, they're called the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority. You've met Mark Norton.
Right.
All of those agencies are members of that. SAPA actually manages the Prop 1 funds for our region. We as a regional board, we watch what they're doing and participate and provide input when we can. But yes, there is coordination amongst that. SAPA does a wonderful job of facilitating that as well. And so hopefully that's a good communication chain. I know when I've talked with Chair Murray and with Board Member Alvarado, we've been trying to figure out ways that we can maybe increase our communication to some of these communities, maybe to include some of the NGOs or some of the active advocacy groups for some of these facilities. And I'm committed to do that. So we will take that for action. But I think we have good connections within the agencies, but I think we can go broader.
Okay. And then as a comment and a question about, comment about Quail Valley, I too went out and actually drove through that whole area. All I can just say is I would hate to be the engineer that would have to design the sewage system out there, you know, actually being able to lay down all the pipes and then with all the hills in there, all the pump stations and lift stations, and you've got narrow streets. I mean, it's an incredible challenge. And it kind of leads me to my next question is, through our efforts here, the HRTW efforts, are we seeing any other Quail Valleys out there in our region?
I do think that up in San Bernardino County, there are some potential sites, and we have begun some discussions with some of those areas. Maybe not to the degree. Quail Valley was really quite unique in that it really was never meant to be a residence. It was always meant to be kind of a
RV park, or, you know, it was meant to be a park really, and it turned into permanent residence. So it was putting these homes into, anyway, I digress. But there are some areas where there are septic systems that that we are having some, so we would like to see them sewered.
Yeah. So, and would they be identified in the report that's produced, which I'll ask about in a second?
I think so. What I would like to do, because, you know, this is kind of a public setting, is we're trying to get a commitment from some of the cities to partner with us to bring sewer to that area. So we're kind of working internally. Mm-hmm. And so once those begin to be fruitful, I think we can begin to put them out for public interest.
Okay.
So it's still kind of in its infancy, if that's okay with you.
Yeah. I also saw about the Inland Empire Utility Agency's plant out in the Chino Basin area, and among other things, it removes TCE in addition to nitrates and TDS and a number of other things. And it reminds me of a similar project that I worked on probably almost 20 years ago now. And it was actually with, when I was the DTSC, and also with this water board and with Orange County Water District, where we actually negotiated with Navy on a desalination plant just down the freeway from here that actually treats contaminated groundwater at El Toro Marine Base. And that was, by the way, a very challenging negotiation, because initially the Department of the Navy, who controlled the entire base, denied that their base was a cause of TCE. And it was only when we finally presented all the data, the preponderance of the data, that they finally stepped up to it and ultimately constructed that that treatment plant. I guess my last question, as I understand it, this board approved a work plan, I think about 2.5 years ago, and I think a report is going to be due this December. So if you can tell us a little bit about what the endpoint is going to be for this particular work plan, and then what would we see beyond it?
Well, I think what we're going to do, you can add. So with the work plan, what we'll do is we have some identified tasks within it. I don't have that list in front of me, so I'm just going to speak in a general sense. But we're going through each one of those tasks, and it is to begin to incorporate some of these things into our program. And we will tell you where we're at and where we're going. After looking at the information that we do have right now, I think we might begin to develop maybe some new ideas on how to do kind of the next phase of it. The work plan was really identified to be information gathering. What are we doing, and where do we sit? And I think we're getting to the place where we understand that. And now I think what we're going to do is just begin to put more emphasis on specific areas or programs or outreach. But you will see in the report our coordination with the Division of Drinking Water, where we're trying to identify impaired water projects. Celia talked about some of these projects are put on our SEP list, but also, you know, the SEP funding is not something that's we can always rely on. It's really based on penalties. So we're making sure some of those projects are actually in the queue for some of these additional monies that Didi Diadamo talked about. And so I would like us to see some of those projects move forward and get high on the list for correction. So those will be the kinds of things that we cover in the work plan. But I do think that we're ready to shift into maybe not changing directions, but adding to and maybe have more of a focused approach in some specific areas. That's kind of what I'm predicting will happen, but we're going to need some months just to kind of talk it through and figure out what good next steps are.
Because I think it would be worthwhile having a report that's submitted when all the tasks are done, saying, what did we do under these tasks? What did we find under these tasks? And then what are our next steps? And especially, I think what we'll all on the board be looking for are those tangible milestones that, you know, we can then track, you know, through all the way through to their completion, such as all the new projects. And then by far, I mean, I don't see this as an effort that's ever going to end. I mean, we're going to have to continue to monitor all these communities. Mm-hmm. As I've often told people, I don't think we're in a drought. I think we're in a long-term I guess the best word to use is aridification of California. Mm-hmm. And as our climate becomes more and more arid, our groundwater aquifers are going to be changing. They're going to be dropping. And a lot of communities are going to suddenly are suddenly going to be vulnerable to losing their water sources. So this is something we're going to be in for the long term.
Yep. Agree. Absolutely.
I just want to add a little bit. You touched on it a second ago, and you said that the human right to water, it's never really going to have an endpoint. So I just wanted to circle back, and I'm very familiar with the work plan. There are lots of things on the work plan that we've noticed. Let me rephrase that. As we've had these conversations, as we pulled in the data, as we've started applying this in some of our programs, we realized that some of the tasks may have been a little off mark and maybe not really where we needed to go. So I will preface that and you know, say that about it, because that is really what we're finding. And the more we learn, the more we discuss it amongst ourselves with staff and all the divisions and programs, we may have been a little off target with some of the tasks. So this is kind of where we decided to shift the presentation onto this view. We're working on human right to water and touching it in various different ways. But as far as like a final process, like we completed all of these things, we definitely can and will. But I just wanted to throw out there that as we have these conversations and more data and staff perspectives come into play, we do find ourselves shifting around a little. So I just want to throw that out there.
That's always the reality. Whenever you implement a work plan, there's always going to be some tasks initially identified that either just I can't get done, or you have to make changes to them. And that's normal. That's expected.
Yep. I'd even just like to echo that comment, and that I hope it will continue to evolve, because as our infrastructure ages, as our climate changes, we need all of those perspectives around the table to make sure that our programs are organic and they're evolving, and we're communicating it again at a community level to ensure we're addressing these issues, because it is, these resources are going to become even more dire as far as access, and being a keyword, access and quality. So anyway, and affordability, of course. So with that, I just have a couple, if there's no other comments from the board, I just wanted to ask that these were great PowerPoints, the data presented, Celia. Thank you for those maps, because it really shows across the board in our region that there aren't just a few hotspots. We have significant areas that are impacted in those red zones and or in those evolving into red zones. And we have to make sure those communities get the resources they need. And the maps and the data, I think, are an important illustration to back up our request for advocacy on funding and policy and ways to, again, get these resources to the community level. Love it. So if we can put those PowerPoints on our website, and again, as part of our advancing communications effort, try to promote and push those out through regular communications to our stakeholder groups and agencies, that would be great. I just want to thank you both for how thorough our efforts are. And it's not just, you know, data focused, but it's really clear that the passion is there from the staff to address these issues and to put that emphasis in all of our programs. So thank you for that. I'd also like to thank all the members of the Quail Valley Task Force that we've been meeting for a couple of years now. And I do see the progress happening there. And it's clear that people are rowing in the same direction and agree and prioritize the needs for Quail Valley. We certainly have many more communities that need that level of focus. So it's just a comfort to know that our staff is so engaged and working with our state partners, federal partners, and others to address these issues. Yeah. Thank you. I'll give Jane a moment to come on back up to the helm up here. And we will move on to item 9. Which is an information item as well, and we'll provide an update on the investigation of PFAS contamination in our region. And Chuck Griffin is here to present the item, and I will turn the floor over to you. Are we ready to go? Did I miss something? Okay, no worries.
Hey, good morning, Chair Murray and members of the board. I'm Chuck Griffin. I'm the enforcement coordinator for our region. This item is an information item. It's discussion of our enforcement program and our region's enforcement priorities for fiscal year 22 and 23. Next slide. I want to tell you a little bit about what we do behind the scenes. Staff discover violations usually through inspections or through file reviews. We then go through and we verify whether or not a violation actually occurred. The violation is brought to the discharge's attention, and it's either done verbally, in an email, or through a letter such as a notice of violation or notice of noncompliance. Depending on the type and severity of the violation, staff provide a compliance assistance to bring the dischargers back to compliance. Staff monitor progress to see whether compliance is achieved, and in majority of the cases, it ends here. To go further into detail, progressive enforcement contemplates an escalating series of actions, beginning with the notification of violations and compliance assistance, followed by enforcement orders, compelling compliance, culminating in a complaint of civil liabilities if necessary. Staff put a significant amount of effort into working with the dischargers to gain compliance through informal enforcement and formal enforcement. There's a reason why the slide is organized in the way it is. It shows a preferred path. It is meant to highlight time schedule orders, CDOs and cleanup and abatement orders, or cease and desist orders and cleanup and abatement orders are enforcement tools. They bring their dischargers back into compliance through allowing them time, providing milestones that they must meet, and then if necessary, a clear understanding that if compliance is not achieved, administrative civil liabilities may be opposed. Staff meet with the dischargers to gain cooperation and compliance through negotiations and compromise. Prior to coming before the board, the details are worked out ahead of time and brought before the board to issue the order, usually in mutual consent. Administrative civil liabilities are reserved for blatant, non-compliant, serious violation, or intentional violations. For some administrative civil liabilities, this too can be worked out ahead of time, and usually it's brought before the board as an uncontested item. On the rare occasion that we do take an ACL before the board and it's contested, it's offered a full hearing in which the board's prosecution team and the discharger are allowed to present facts, and then the board decides on the outcome of that administrative civil liability. Next slide. So why do we enforce? We do so to gain compliance, to create a deterrence for non-compliance, and to provide a level playing field. Next slide. The enforcement policy seeks to establish a fair, firm, consistent, and transparent approach for determining financial liability by providing a methodology for arriving at a liability amount that's consistent with the objectives mentioned in the slide, such as to eliminate economic advantage for non-compliance, eliminate any unfair competitive advantage, apply findings that are evidence-based and policy-based, and provides a deterrence for both the specific discharger and their community. Next slide. Coming back to the discussion of enforcement priorities, the enforcement policy recommends that on an annual basis, the enforcement staff of each regional water board seek input on a regularly noticed public meeting, such as today, of the regional water board, and consider identifying general enforcement priorities based on the input from members of the public and members of this board. These priorities support the water board's mission, and I always like to repeat this, to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of water resources and drinking water for the protection of the environment, public health, beneficial uses, and to ensure proper water resource allocation and efficient use for the benefit of present and future generations. Next slide. Consistent with what was mentioned with the enforcement policy, the enforcement priorities seek to provide a fair, firm, consistent, and transparent enforcement posture. It takes into weight the struggle to meet human right to water, areas seeking environmental justice, and where violations are in disadvantaged communities or tribal considerations. Next slide. The enforcement priorities presented today are based on the board's organization, which we are broken up into three branches. The Groundwater Protection Branch is led by Eric Lindberg. the Surface Water and Agricultural branches led by Nick Amini, and the Planning Implementation Program branches led by Lama Willis. Next slide. The groundwater branch, it consists of the site cleanup section, land disposal and DOD section, underground tanks, storage tank, and site cleanup sections in my unit, the enforcement unit. They have identified the following as the enforcement priorities: to ensure a timely implementation of cleanup of contaminated sites, including industrial spill sites, underground storage tanks, and Department of Defense sites, facilities, and the prioritized by the risk to human health and the environment, the threat to beneficial uses, and the environmental justice. Next, they ensure compliance with waste discharge requirements for municipal waste facilities, surface impoundments, and in-situ remediation to minimize impacts to groundwater quality and drinking water supply, and to prioritize projects which discharges have demonstrated a pattern of failing to meet requirements specified in waste discharge requirements, voluntary cleanup agreements, investigative orders, or cleanup and abatement orders. Next slide. The Surface Water and Agricultural Branch consists of the stormwater, coastal and inland sections, the wastewater section, and the agricultural and cannabis sections. The following are enforcement priorities identified for the Surface Water Agricultural Branch. They want to focus on compliance with stormwater discharge permits for industrial facilities that incur total maximum daily load numeric effluent limitation exceedances. Pay particular attention to the efforts of the MS4 authorities towards meeting water quality objectives for receiving waters through implementation of the monitoring programs as presented in their annual reports. They want to focus on the illegal cannabis cultivation sites, those unpermitted sites that have the potential to impact streams, listed impaired water bodies, and wild and scenic waters. In addition, the consideration will be made for the size and density of the cultivation sites, the potential to threaten drinking water supplies, and those sites near disadvantaged communities and overdrafted groundwater basins and other conserved lands. Next slide. To continue with the Surface Water and Agricultural Branch, they also want to focus on compliance with effluent limitations and discharge permits for wastewater programs, and to encourage dischargers to connect to local sanitary sewer systems when necessary. They want to concentrate on working on agricultural dischargers to enroll in the program, submit their notices and compliance reports. And they want to focus on dischargers in the dairy program that have failed to submit their annual reports. Next slide. The Planning and Implementation Branch consists of the following: regional planning, inland planning, and coastal planning. The planning branch writes requirements for direct impacts to state and federal surface water bodies, among numerous other responsibilities. For the state surface water bodies, this branch writes waste discharge requirements. And for federal surface water bodies, they write requirements through the federal 401 certification program. Many of the projects associated with waste discharge or 401 certification requirements are complex and can last years before they complete the project. The enforcement priority identified for this branch seeks to address noticeable trend where project proponents are either failing to submit annual reports, failing to notify staff when they begin a project, or failing to notify the staff when they've terminated or complete their projects. Next slide. This enforcement effort seeks to reduce the number of facilities in violation and also seeks to do so through progressive enforcement. Like all enforcement priorities, staff will seek, where legally allowed, an informal approach to achieving compliance. And where that fails, it will implement a progressive enforcement posture. Staff have presented these enforcement priorities, but we also want to take input from the board at any time to add or change enforcement priorities as we go along. This concludes my presentation. Does the board have any questions?
Members of the board, any questions on the presentation? Director Rue.
Not so much a question, but a point of, I guess, commendation. What you're trying to do with the issue of the illegal marijuana facilities and things of that sort, it is to be commended. It's a very difficult job to try to find them. But the water use is very intense And I think the more we can look at any illegal activity going on, the better off we are to protect our waters, the region water. So thank you.
Our cannabis section does a lot of work behind the scenes. There's no doubt about that.
Thank you, Director Rue. Any other members? Yep, Director Scandura.
Yeah, just a couple things. First of all, I just wanted to say in my 33 years at DTSC, it was always a pleasure to work with, you know, not only this water board, but other water boards as well, because from time to time, we did have some very tough, very difficult, responsible parties, and they pose major compliance issues. And so our agencies joining together, pooling our resources, pooling our data often was key to a very successful enforcement effort, and especially in my area, which was cleaning up hazardous waste sites. I was also going to mention, because there was, you know, at the beginning of the presentation, the discussion of the progressive enforcement approach. And I know that some people that are outside of this field or maybe, you know, more in the activist community may say, well, why doesn't an agency just apply the maximum hammer, the maximum possible force right up front? And the reality is that, you know, we have to remember that regulated entities, the dischargers, the facilities that are out there have their own rights. So we have to make sure that the enforcement action that we do undertake fits the magnitude of the violation out there. The other thing is that if we do take enforcement action that winds up going to court, oftentimes those court actions can be very expensive. I was told, in fact, by a staff at the Attorney General's office, staff attorney, that enforcement actions can cost up to $300,000 to $400,000 minimum. So it's a very expensive effort. So that's why the progressive enforcement approach of attempting to achieve compliance first, and then only when it's there's just no way they can get cooperation or compliance, then we go with a more aggressive approach. But there are always going to be those times when the violations are so egregious that you really have no choice but to take your maximum approach. And I always think of those facilities, the guys that run a hose from their wastewater tank to the toilet or from the wastewater tank to the storm drain. And believe it or not, that has happened in the past. And it's you know, the agencies in those situations have no choice but to take action. But really appreciate the presentation and look forward to seeing all your work from this end of things.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Scandura. Director Alvarado, did you want to say anything? Or just
thank you for the great presentation. And I really agree on the work that is being done to have a very transparent oversight, and specifically to have reports like this so that the community knows that there is a path and that there is a progressive right path so that we can also assist those businesses or whoever is in violation. So there is not the extreme, but it's also a way for them to fix it. And there's time for them to actually be in compliance. Thank you.
I'd like to echo my colleagues' comments. The report is so important, the program behind it. PFAS is so pervasive and has been with us for so long that addressing it and cleaning it up effectively and, again, making sure we have quality water supplies as a result of PFAS infiltration is going to be a monumental effort. And so I love that it's a transparent but forceful and approach that has some real steady metrics to it, and anything that we can do to be supportive or helping to get the word out to our community members, you know, we stand by and ready to serve. So thank you for your efforts, and thank you, Jane, for the entire team's efforts on this effort.
Thank you.
Okay, I'll move on to item 10, which is our executive officer's report.
Yeah, can I do it from up here, guys? Can you just put the slides up? Is that okay? Just real quick. But I just have some slides instead of a written report. I just have three items to go through, and we can go to the next slide. The first one, next slide. So this is the racial equity work plans. This has come up several times already. We do have two more meetings that are scheduled after today. Virtual, you know, like a hybrid meeting, so you can join from your home. But, you know, the racial equity, it is a board's priority. And these workshops are designed to collect information from the public. And I just want to state that we have also been involved. There's a team of people up at the state board. And we also have Celia Pazzo sits on this team and represents the Region 8. And so this group is working on developing of this action plan. So what they're doing at these public meetings, they have done internally with water board staff. And I was involved with it. It was very, very good. There's some great ideas out there. A lot of creative thought. And what I find is that the leaders in our water boards organizations are really embracing this concept and wanting to look at how to improve our culture within and also help our communities on the outside. So I would encourage participation in these plans. And then once that plan becomes completed, we'll bring that back to the board. Next slide. We also have a workshop. We're calling it a staff level public workshop coming up August 2nd. It's down in that yellow box at the bottom. It'll be held at the Riverside Public Library. It's a brand new library. It's a new facility. It's really nice. And it'll be more of a classroom setting so that we'll have the opportunity to listen to the permittees will be there. I think some of the NGOs will be there. Some of the other stakeholders outside of the permit who are interested in the permit. It'll be a good opportunity to really talk through that a staff working proposal. I'm trying to save time. This we all know that we issued a staff working proposal back in January of 2022. And just as a reminder, this MS4 permit is taking three existing permits, one per county, combining it into one. And so we have been working very closely with our attorneys and internally, as well as with the permittees, on getting their comments on this staff working proposal. It was our first opportunity to put our ideas on paper. What do you think? And we have had some really robust conversations. Very helpful. And so this workshop on August is just to do more of that collaboration. And then where we go from there, we'll probably, we're still trying to decide whether or not we'll be able to create a document that can go for full public review or not. We might do another working proposal. I'm not sure. I will let you all know. But what again, it's from 1 to 4. I didn't put the time on there. It's from 1 to 4. So it's going to be in the afternoon. And and it will actually be hybrid as well. Correct, Jessica. Yeah, so Jessica's setting that up. Any questions, please reach out to myself.
Could you send perhaps, I know I'd be interested, and I assume the other board members, maybe the virtual links to both those meetings,
yes.
The one in Newport Beach and this one?
Yes.
Yeah, so although I have work things on both days, I might be able to at least join for a few minutes.
Okay, thank you. Will do. And if they are recorded, maybe I can get you the recording if for some reason your schedule doesn't allow. And then the last item, I just wanted to raise and make sure that you all heard that I heard you too, is that, you know, we've talking about this drought, we're talking about conservation, we're talking about the importance of it. And there is regulation that, you know, Didi Diadamo has talked about many times because of the serious situation we're in, that there are some requirements for commercial and industrial facilities to actually conserve. And I know, you know, personally, my residents, I've got mail says, you know, you can only water 3 days a week and that's it. So we have included some of this information on our website as far as a water conservation portal. Jessica's been helpful with that. I just want to point out she's been instrumental in doing that. But again, just as with the human right to water, we will look at avenues of being more than just using our website, but reaching out on some of these things to our communities and to our water agencies. And hopefully we'll have a list for those disadvantaged communities so that we can
we can just, you know, do a broader outreach. That's what I keep hearing, and we will make every effort to do that. So I just wanted to let you know that we will be taking that action. And I did get a text from Jessica. I apologize. There was a commenter for Chuck's item that we need to ask to come up and speak on. My fault.
Oh, great. Jessica, would you please let us know who would like to speak on that item?
Yes, it'll be Lauren Chase.
Yeah, it's the enforcement priorities.
Yeah, item 9.
Sorry, Lauren. Oh, I apologize.
No worries at all. Yeah, I just wanted to touch on a few points of the enforcement action priorities. And thank you so much to board staff for all of their hard work on this. The first is with the goal for the TMDL numeric effluent limitation enforcement. I just wanted to raise to the board's attention that that data is based on self-reporting from dischargers. And what we see in the community is a lot of dischargers that claim there were no rain events sufficient to sample. So we need to make sure we're actually getting that data first in order to assess it and then decide what to do there. And then the other thing I wanted to raise is with regards to compliance with water quality objectives in the MS4 context. With respect to our trash presentation earlier, the forthcoming MS4 Jane was just speaking about, we'll be incorporating the trash policy amendments that include a water quality objective of no trash in surface waters by 2030. So that's a really great way that we can take some real action with source control and hopefully try to minimize waste there. And then touching on board member Scandura's point, as a member of the activist community that often writes letters asking for stricter enforcement, I just wanted to recognize your note there and say that while the progressive enforcement is helpful and necessary, there are times definitely when the heavier hand needs to come into play. For example, I don't just write letters and make public comment. I also am an attorney that files citizen lawsuits under the Clean Water Act. And so we are still working through litigation on a case with a discharger that the board sent notices of violation to in 2017. We filed a complaint in 2018, and that is still ongoing. And definitely the costs for that are high, and we're a community group, so you can take from that what you will. But anyway, that's all I wanted to say on that. Thank you for your time and for allowing me to come back up and speak.
Thank you for your comments and the work that you do.
Thank you for your comments and the work that you do on behalf of the community. Okay, so any questions for our executive officer on her report? Dr. Scandura.
Yes, and actually this may be more of a question for our attorney. So a number of us on the board have to recuse from the proceedings related to the MS4 permit. Would that preclude us from even so much as viewing the workshops virtually?
It's funny that you raised that because I was just thinking along those lines. I don't think it would preclude you from viewing the workshops, but from participating.
So we can view, but asking questions and making comments, that sounds to me that would be all.
Correct. And we can, we'll touch base again on that issue too, outside this forum.
Okay. Yeah. And then I didn't see anything on the, our next agenda item is going to be the tour, but anything about closing comments or anything like that. And if I just wanted to add something. And this was an item that I discussed with the executive officer the other day. First of all, I really want to thank the Orange County Water District for providing the facilities that we have today, and especially for the tour that's going to go on afterwards. And what this has made me think is that I would like to see future meetings of this board at similar kind of facilities, and also offering us the opportunity to tour some of what they have. And in particular, I think of Inland Empire's utility agency. They have desalter plants. We have the Paris desalter plant and quite a number of other facilities that treat or perform some kind of conservation. So and especially I'd like to see those hearings and seeing those tours in the Inland Empire. It's great to come out here, take a look at what's essentially a world-class facility, one of the preeminent water treatment facilities in the world. I mean, that's great, but we do, given that nearly all of us are from Orange County, we do need to see what's going on out in the Inland Empire. Another thing I would like to do, and this is, related along our lines of HRTW efforts, is I would like to see some meetings in communities that are challenged by water, especially disadvantaged communities, communities of color, what have you, where their systems are very vulnerable. I think it helps that we get out into the communities and hear out their concerns. And frankly, I don't care if the meeting is in a you know, a nice place like this with a fancy dais. So when I was a DTSC, we had lots of community meetings that were in community centers where all you had was a couple of folding tables and microphones that you passed back and forth. But I think the ability to get out and interact with members of those communities is what's most valuable for us. So I would like to see that in the future.
Thank you, Director Scandura. We'll move just into the next item, which is board members' closing comments. Director Scandura kicked off, so I'll turn it over to Director Alvarado.
Thank you so much. I just want to thank everyone who spoke, and especially those of you that are working out there with the communities. We know that for us, it's essential that we are not only promoting the work that is being done, but also that we are doing outreach to the communities. I know our executive director touched on that, and it is one of my goals to be out there as a resident of Santa Ana. I can tell you that the disadvantaged communities sometimes do not get the information, the appropriate information, even on a timely basis. And we talked about that. And for me, that is a priority. I want to make sure that when we're talking about safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water, we're talking about information as well. And hopefully we'll be able to reach in several languages and to make sure that every single individual knows that they have the right to water and that they can come in and actually be heard. So for us, that is a priority. And I just want to echo the comments that have been placed at this time with all the work that the staff is doing. You guys are amazing. Let me say that out loud so people know it takes a lot of work to just have the information and share with us. And specifically, the data that is presented to us is not only just reviewed in a meeting. I just want to share with the community that it's reviewed, and this is why some of the workshops are, echoed to the community out loud so that you can view it as well. You are invited to be our guest and to not only speak on it, but learn from all the presentations. With that, thank you.
Thank you, Director Alvarado. Director Wu.
Yes, continuing that vein, I know when I was first on this board, which goes back to 2000, we used to meet in a variety of places. One of the issues we had at that time is some of the places we wanted to meet in communities, they didn't have the parking available. But now we have Zoom and the virtual options, so that's really beneficial. We can start meeting in those places again. It was very beneficial when we would meet. I remember meeting in Rialto when we dealt with perchlorate. I remember meeting in Quail Valley. I can remember meeting in an area that's now called Harupa Valley. And so we met with those communities, and parking sometimes was difficult, but we can overcome that with Zoom now. So this is a good direction to go in. I'm going to segue into the drought. What I noticed from the statistics I see, our lower income and disadvantaged communities seem to be doing a far better job of conserving water than more human communities. And we all are in this together. It's not whether you can afford it or can't afford it. As I like to tell people, you can't drink your green turf. You can't drink your bird of paradise. They're beautiful. But we need to start doing the realities of the world we're in. We're in this together. Whether we're in the coast, whether we're inland, whether we're even Northern California, we have to come together on this. There was a time, and certainly I don't remember it, there's no one in this room that remembers it, but mostly our parents or grandparents would remember it. During the Second World War, on the home front, there was a lot of sacrifice that was asked. Food was rationed. If you didn't have a ration coupon, you couldn't get that bread. If you didn't have a ration coupon, you couldn't get the cheese, even if you had plenty of money. Gasoline was rationed. You were told when you could be on the street and couldn't be on the street. You were told to keep your drapes shut at certain times. Don't let any music or sound come out of your house because there's an air raid drill. Whether Americans liked it or not, they understood that we were in this together. We have to have that same attitude on the drought. We can't have the thing of, and I've heard this from people, well, I spend so much money on my yard, I want to keep it beautiful. Well, you did, but that was then, this is now. And we need to really make this something that we're in together. We're one California. And it really distresses me when I see that there's some communities just kind of ignoring the rules. As I said, I'm very proud that our low-income communities or disadvantaged communities, they're doing a great job putting back. They really are. They're getting the message. They've seen the message. But it seems we have this divide that because I can afford it, I'm better than somebody else. And we all need to realize we're in this together, because it doesn't matter. If next year we're still in this drought, which we will be, we're going to see a lot more restrictions put in place. So let's all just join together, do what we can, understand that, well, for a few years, you may not have beautiful looking front yards. People may have dirt. Help them. If you see a neighbor who's struggling to try to do something with their yard, go over and help them, because we're in this for the long term. Thanks.
Thank you, Director Rue. Very well said. This is definitely an issue that isn't going away anytime soon. And before it gets to the point of, well, Lake Mead is already there for anyone who's not paying attention, it's many states that are going to be in very dire circumstances if we don't reduce consumption and ensure the welfare of our natural resources. So it's very, very important that everybody is complying and doing everything they can to go above, not just to meet, but to go above and beyond the guidelines that are in place today. And then I'd just like to ask that we also post all the PowerPoints from the meeting today on our website. And I just want to share that Didi Diamo, our state liaison, our executive officer, Jane Joy, and I have been talking about ways to really get more of the state information out to our local communities. And so we're going to be working on some proactive communications, and look forward to having my board member, fellow board members, participate in that effort. But we really want to make sure we're getting that information out to a grassroots level. And I appreciate the partnership on that with Didi and with Jane and her team. So thank you for all of that. And I just want to wish everyone the very best. We do have our OCWD tour that is starting shortly, and we're pretty close to on time, which is great. It'll be a 1-hour tour, and I encourage anyone who wants to stay and participate in that to do so. Unfortunately, it will not be available online. It is a required meeting in person. And with that, I will ask, do we have any closed session items today? No. So we will adjourn our meeting then at 11:16, and our next regular board meeting will be September 9th at 9 a.m., and you can follow our website for more information. With that, thank you, everyone. God bless, and have a great day.
I'm quite as good as yours, but it's hey. I'll do it right.
You like it up there?
I'm so sorry about that.
I know, turn the ring around.
Situation at home that my wife is talking to Tiki. She said, I see something. And I thought I shut it out twice and it keeps ringing. I don't know how did that be.
Well, you know, I sit there and I see everybody. Gloria wasn't, Skandura wasn't. But oh, Jane and Chris and Bill were all there. I'm going to say something.
Hey, how are you? Good presentation. Are you? Yeah. Like last minute. My wife is going to get technician. Yeah, so I thought I shut it off. But it keeps coming. I turned the voice down to vibrate and then it keeps coming. You know, just shut it down. That it doesn't make me.
I just shut it off and just turn it on right here. Just like here.